Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As Tuesday's election looms, we will begin with an overview of voting in America with a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation. Richard Hassan, the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, joins us to discuss fraudulent charges of voter fraud on the right and voting machine conspiracy theories on the left that together have diminished confidence Americans have in the integrity of voting. Then we will speak with one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to everyday life. Joining us is Toby Miller, a professor at the City University of London, where he has an article at their website, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. We will discuss the irony that wealth-producing and knowledge-generating centers in the blue states of the country, like New York and California, that vote Democrat, subsidize Republican right-wing welfare in socialist red states who vote Republican. Then finally, we'll examine how much Mitt Romney has got away with in the election due to our pathetic press and the feckless Democrats who have not forced him to reveal his taxes and list of bundlers. We'll discuss another aspect of Mitt Romney that has also been off limits, his role as a member of Mormon royalty and his connection to the vast finances generated by tithing that the secretive hierarchy of the Mormon prophet and his disciples have at their disposal. Kay Birmingham, the author of An American Fraud, One Lawyer's Case Against Mormonism, joins us. And joining us now is Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he is the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published in numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Review. His latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hassan.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And just today, on Sunday, in Florida, there's a last-minute lawsuit from the Florida Democrats trying to extend early voting because of long lines. Of course, the governor has no sympathy for that. He'd already been sued because he tried to stop the whole process of early voting, at least in terms of the time. And now we also learn on Friday that this Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, a Republican, has in a last-minute 11th-hour legal move, which many people think could swing the entire election, he issued a directive that lays out requirements for submitting provisional ballots, and the directive includes a form which puts the burden on the voter to correctly record the form of ID provided to election officials. This, of course, is all part of the myriad of tricks in this torturous voting wars that we have in this country. But in those cases, in both these key states, Florida and Ohio, are these latest examples likely to be as effective as some people are reporting?
Well, I've been saying all along that the extent to which these rule changes make a difference has been exaggerated by the left, and that the amount of votes that are at stake with these kinds of changes is very small. However, especially in Florida right now, the polling looks extremely close. We saw very contradictory polls yesterday. It's not clear who's going to win. And if we're talking about, again, a Florida 2000 type margin, which was maybe 1,000 votes, 500 votes, 2,000 votes, you know, depending on what time period we looked at, then these small changes like cutbacks in early voting could, in fact, make a difference. It's the same thing with the situation in the state of Ohio right now, although the polling is not quite as close. At least most of the polling shows President Obama with a small but persistent lead. But if it does come down to the provisional ballots, the fight here now is over counting provisional ballots that have mistakes on them. And the courts have already ruled, contrary to what the Ohio officials wanted, that if there's a mistake in the casting of a provisional ballot caused by a poll worker, the ballot has to be counted. And so what it looks like Husted is doing here is trying to put the onus on the voter. And so if the voter makes the mistake, those ballots won't be counted and there won't be any recourse in the federal courts for that.
Well, he has. The Secretary of State of Ohio has instructed the election officials that if the form is not filled out correctly by the voter, the ballot should not be counted. But you're saying that that would eventually be tested with a lawsuit.
Well, it's already being tested in a lawsuit. So this was challenged, and there was an emergency motion filed over the weekend. And the same judge who ruled earlier that those provisional ballots that were caused by poll worker error, that those have to be counted, is before the same judge, and the judge has asked Husted to respond by Monday as to how these ballots are going to be handled. I should point out that under the rules that Ohio has put out, these provisional ballots will not even start to be counted until November 17th. So if we as a country are unlucky enough to have the election come down to Ohio, and it's a very close margin in Ohio, it's going to be weeks before we find out who's won that election.
Well, we know, I think, Richard Hassan, that the storm, for example, in New Jersey and New York is going to depress the popular vote. And there's a sense that perhaps Obama will win the Electoral College and perhaps Romney will win the popular vote. And with a million votes now not coming from these blue states, New York and New Jersey, that will depress the popular vote for Obama. And, of course, people who vote for the Green candidates and others, even though some, I did a interview the other day with a very soporific, a so-called progressive, who were just mad at Obama, like most of the progressives, the people who call themselves progressives apparently are, saying that, well, you can vote your conscience in other states like California, but not in the swing states. You have to vote against Romney. And I pointed out, well, that's going to depress the popular vote, which is important. How important do you think the popular vote would be? My sense is the Tea Party people already think this president is illegitimate and a Muslim from Kenya. So if we end up with that scenario with Obama winning the presidency but losing the popular vote, won't the Tea Party people be riled up?
Well, I think that if there's an Obama victory, the Tea Party people will be riled up either way. I was actually heartened a little bit to see that someone like Dick Morris and also Karl Rove were making noises that if Obama wins, it's going to be because of the luck of Hurricane Sandy hitting when it did. That's better than the alternative of saying that there's been voter fraud, which has marred the outcome of the election. In my book, The Voting Wars, I talk about how on the Republican side, there's been a great hue and cry about an epidemic of voter fraud, but most of this is manufactured, and the kind of fraud that happens is not the kind of fraud that the Republicans are addressing in this new wave of laws that they've been passing.
So again, I'm speaking with Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation. And his latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And it's pretty hard to believe that after the shame of Florida in 2000, when a lot of Americans suddenly felt that their electoral system was like that of a banana republic, and there was a flurry of legislative attempts and a lot of money was spent, and of course nothing improved, and the FCC is essentially a broken government watchdog. And as you've just mentioned, Richard Hassan, you've got on the right side of the political spectrum, you've got these fraudulent fraud squads and this whole idea of voter fraud, which is largely a myth, being propagated. And on the left, you've got these conspiracy theories about rigged voting machines, and people have been crying wolf forever about Diebold and other things. So the overall picture is pretty murky. Can you clarify it a little bit?
Well, I do think that we as a country learned the wrong lessons since 2000. One of the things I show is that the amount of election litigation has more than doubled. People's confidence in the fairness of the election process has gone down. And it turns out that when you're on the losing side of an election, you're more likely to believe that the way the system was run was somehow rigged or unfair than if you're on the winning side of the election. It's part of, a consequence of the hyper-polarized society we live in right now. And I do think that that spawns conspiracy theories on the left and the right, and it leaves room for provocateurs and political entrepreneurs to further fan the flames and undermine the legitimacy of our whole process. And what we need to do, and I argue at the end of my book, is move to the kind of system they have in most mature democracies, which is nationalized, nonpartisan election administration run by professionals who are adequately staffed and independently insulated from political pressures. we are just so far from that. Since 2000, we haven't moved in that direction. If anything, we've moved in the opposite direction. Things have become much more politicized than they were before.
Well, the impression I get, Richard Hassan, is that neither party really wants to fix this broken system. First of all, the states administer it, and that goes back to the founding fathers. The first demand of the 13 colonies was that they had to conduct independent elections. And that I recall that after 9/11, in the Patriot Act, there was a provision for a national ID card because there was a sense that because these hijackers were apparently running around the U.S. with all kinds of IDs that are readily available. The notion was that in order to have homeland security, you have to know who's in this country to begin with, have to do a kind of inventory. So I'm always wondered why, you know, we can't make a deal with the devil here. For progressives who are concerned, you know, they don't want to have the Gestapo saying, show me your papers on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you have a national ID card and it's used for elections, the same government that gives you an ID card can't say that you're voting fraudulently. I mean, that's how the rest of the world operates. Do you think it'll ever happen? I mean, or a better question might be, why doesn't it happen?
Yeah, well, I think, I've proposed for years that we move to a system of universal voter registration conducted by the government, the federal government. And as part of that deal, you move to a national ID card, and you include with it, if a voter wants, a thumbprint. This would be at the voter's option, and the voter could use the thumbprint in lieu of the card because you're not going to lose your thumb. I like to say this is a proposal that has united Democrats and Republicans because it's united them against the idea. Republicans don't want to expand the electorate. They don't want to have universal registration, and Democrats don't want the ID card. I think it gets caught up in issues related to immigration. It gets caught up with libertarians and privacy advocates, gets caught up on that side. And the broader point is that there doesn't seem to be common space for electoral reforms right now. If you look at the wave of voter ID laws, with the exception of Rhode Island, they've all been passed by Republican legislators and opposed by Democratic legislators. Out here in California, if you look at Election Day registration, it's supported only by Democrats and opposed by Republicans. And so it's very hard in the midst of this strong period of party polarization to find this kind of common ground. And I would have liked to think that Florida 2000 would have been the wake-up call, but it didn't work out that way. And I don't know if it's going to take another election meltdown before the country is willing to wake up and take some steps to have a mature system for running the elections.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, and his latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. So you would think, though, the only way I think to fix this would be for the American people to be sufficiently ashamed of this embarrassingly broken system that's so easily gamed and has been gamed since the beginning of the Republic, routinely. And both parties, for various reasons, have deadlocked any efforts to reform it. So perhaps if people were sufficiently outraged and just wanted this nonsense to stop, they may be able to weigh in, because I don't personally understand the motivations for the kind of mendacity and malice that the governor of Florida and the secretary of state of Ohio are exhibiting now. I mean, the idea that in a democracy you don't want people to vote should be considered an absolute disgrace.
Well, I have a piece today in the Sacramento Bee where I argue that at bottom this is not just, although it is somewhat about partisan gain, it's also a difference of philosophies about the nature of voting. I think Republicans are much more likely to view voting as about choosing the best candidate. And if that's what it's about, then you can imagine excluding voters who you think are not intelligent enough or literate enough or who have not shown sufficient ties to the community. So you could have property tests and all of these things. And so cutbacks in early voting and making it harder for people to vote is supposed to wean out those who shouldn't be voting in the first place. And if you take that philosophy, I think you can understand some of the approaches that are coming from the right. On the left, I think elections are viewed more as allocation of power among political equals. And if you take that view, then you want to be as inclusive as possible. For the Democrats to claim inclusion, you have to realize there's some self-interest there, too. The broader the electorate, the more likely it is there are going to be these casual voters who sometimes vote and sometimes don't, who are going to favor the Democratic Party. It's not a coincidence that Democrats don't want to take steps to remove ineligible voters from the voting rolls, like non-citizens, which we know is a real but small problem, because they'd rather err on the side of inclusion, while Republicans would rather err on the side of exclusion. And what we really need is somebody whose allegiance is to the integrity of the electoral process, who says that the goal is to make sure that all eligible voters, but only eligible voters, can cast a vote which will be fairly and accurately counted. It's very simple to state, but it's hard to find a mechanism to get that into place.
So just in closing then, Richard Hassan, in this election, which is coming up in the next couple of days, and there's last-minute campaigning in the swing states, I mean, to begin with, the idea that this is a 18th-century system of electoral college voting that essentially disenfranchises about 80% of the population? I mean, most of us don't even know, except for the propositions here in California, we wouldn't even know there's an election going on compared to the bombardment that's going on in the swing states. So,
yeah, well, you'd know it if you were asked to give money, which many Californians have.
That's true. We're the ATM for the Democratic
New
Party.
York, California, and Texas serve that different role in the presidential election.
Texas is the Republican ATM.
Yes.
So, but just address that idea of do you, because there's a simple way to get rid of the Electoral College, which is underway, right?
You're talking about the national popular vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's actually less simple. I mean, first of all, it's interesting that the states that have passed this, the way this would work is if it passed enough states making up to 270 votes, all those states would pledge their electors to the national popular vote winner. Two problems. One is it's only passing in Democratic states. This has become another partisan issue. And the other is that I think there are serious constitutional questions as to whether or not this U.S. Supreme Court would allow this kind of agreement among the states to go through without congressional approval. There's a part of the Constitution, the Compact Clause, that prevents these states from making certain kinds of agreements without congressional approval. And so I would not trust this proposal before the current Supreme Court.
Well, and would the states that now are the swing states, would they be resistant to this? Is there any advantage to them for having being the beneficiaries of this anomaly?
Well, certainly the television stations are benefiting quite a great deal in Ohio and Florida. But I think that, you know, with the small states that would get even less attention than under a system of popular vote. Imagine where Romney and Obama would have been campaigning if they were trying to pick up as many popular votes as possible. They'd spend all their time in California, New York, and Florida. It would be a very different kind of election. It's just hard to see us moving away from the current system. You know, our Constitution has been built to make change very difficult. And now, in a very partisan and polarized era, change is even more difficult. It's hard to find people in the middle who are willing to compromise. That's putting a stop to all kinds of good election reforms.
So we're spending $6 billion on this election to end up with the status quo. That's not a message.
Well, yeah, but then you get down to how you're going to fix it, and there's very little agreement about what to do about it. And also there's, the impediment of the Supreme Court and what the court's willing to do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Hassan.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he is the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published by numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Review. His latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the Republican red states in this country operate on socialist right-wing welfare.
From the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, the mock.